This is Mark Green, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 27th of March 2011. Mark Green, Part 1.
My name is Mark Green. I was born on the 7th of February 1962 in Bristol.
What sort of education did you have, Mark?
Normal at the time for, well, comprehensive secondary.
University?
No. Further education? Left school, couldn't wait to leave school. and yeah, I wanted something practical, so lucky enough at the time, 1978, to get a job, and even better to get an apprenticeship. So
in what trade?
In actually, it was pipe fitting, welding, heating and ventilation. Yeah.
Was that a lifelong career?
I didn't look at it like that at the time. You know, you've got your mates and you go to work and you like the trade, you learn the trade. But I never saw it as a lifelong thing. Once you go down a road like that, and you do tend to get a bit stuck because the family comes along, the mortgage comes along, and it's the best way for, you know, to earn money. So, yeah.
Well, here you were three decades later still doing it, weren't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Had you travelled much?
No, not really. I used to travel daily to Reading, which is, well, past Reading, which is a couple of hours drive and back every day, but not, you know.
I meant abroad, really.
Random Ed, the usual places. Not many places in the world I would like to go and see. Very selective. A few parts of America, bits of Africa.
But you've not got there yet?
No, if I don't get there, not really a bother.
Because you said to me on the phone you were something of a home bird. Is that still the case?
No, we're home birds. We're not ones for sort of going down to pub and, you know, going out and stuff like that. We like each other's company.
So why the heck did he want to go to the Antarctic then?
Yeah, that's a good one. Well, I've been moaning at Anna for, God, years that I was sort of fed up with doing the same thing. Week in, week out, month in, month out. And I just heard it on the radio one night and I said, well, how about this? And she had a listen and she said, go for it. So I think we both realised what an opportunity it would be. I don't know if we actually realised the implications of being apart or, you know the magnitude of the thing, really.
Had the Antarctic crossed your consciousness before in any way?
No. You see programmes and you're in awe of, you know, what you see. But you never
life
actually,
in the freezer, that kind of thing?
Yeah, you never actually think you're going to get to a place like that. Yeah.
So is it true to say you had no particular ambition to go there until you heard the radio?
I didn't think it was possible for, you know, people like me to go to Antarctica. I thought it was all scientists and,
That suggests you kind of thought about it earlier. Or
No. No.
So you heard the radio interview.
Yeah.
You consulted your partner.
Yeah.
Then what?
And then I applied.
Can you remember much about the application form? Was there anything in there which made you irresistible to them?
I think I just put down who I was. I didn't try and pretend to be somebody else. I just answered the questions as honestly as I could about me, because if I was the sort of guy that they wanted, then they'd have me. If not, if you're away for, you know, 15, 16 months and you're not who you say you are, then you're going to get found out. Yeah.
How did you react when you realised you'd got an interview?
A little bit, I don't know, because my interview was for, I'd missed the intake for the year that I applied. So the interview was quite a few months away, wasn't it? About 5 months away. So it was, right, okay, it's 5 months away. As the time got, I was told I would have an interview, I think, in March, and I think March came and went. And I didn't hear anything, so I phoned up. And because the advertising campaign. I think it had a huge response, and they were just sifting through people and making a cut, and said that I would be interviewed. So, you know, I just sort of, okay, you know, just go and see what it's all about. Yeah.
Did it, when it was one step nearer, were you any more nervous or confident or?
Oh, no, nervous, no. My confidence went from, oh, yeah, well, I know, you know, this is the job for me. I know my job. I can do this. I can get on with people. To, oh, my God, I'm too old. You know, I'm not the sort of person they want. You know, that, you know, it sort of fluctuated, not day by day, but, you know.
Can you explain a bit more about why you felt you were right for the job, bearing in mind you'd never been there?
Well, the actual heating, ventilation, plumbing job, I knew I could do. I mean, I think on my application form, that's one thing I can remember, when they put previous experience, I think I just put, I know I can do the job, which, you know, heating systems, plumbing, I don't really need to go into big depth about that. I knew I'd be questioned about it. But some of the points were, do you get on with people? And, you know, they said you had to help out with the cooking, the cleaning, and it was like, you know, and all the other various base tasks that appealed. So, yeah, I think that's why I thought I would fit in, yeah.
What do you remember of the interview when it came?
Not too much, actually. Maybe two questions. They asked me to sell myself. and I think I said, well, I don't know how to sell myself. I've only had one interview in the past, you know, 30 years. So I rambled on about something, as I'll probably ramble on in this interview if I can't think of something to say. And I think when pushed, I think I said, well, if I haven't got the job by now, I don't think I'm going to get it anyway. So that was, you know, that was, the other bits were, how do you think you can get on with people? Actually, yes, coming back, one of the questions was, how do you know, if everybody was in a funk, how would you cheer them up? And I said, well, I know how to cheer my young son up when he was in one, but sort of, 10 people I don't know, yeah? How do you, you know, people have got to be treated differently. Some people like to be left alone. And I did say that I used to put a sock on my hand into a puppet for my son, and he said, yeah, that would go down well at Halley, so, yeah.
do you think you're kind of being sussed out psychologically?
Oh, that's, I don't know. That's no, that's what you think before, I think, the interview. That's a hard one. I haven't actually revisited that. You know, I thought that before I went to the interview, how, you know, what sort of questions are they going to ask me and stuff like that, but I haven't revisited that at all, no.
So there was no overt psychological questioning?
Well, not that I picked up on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So you came out of the interview, and had you changed your view of whether you might get the job or not?
No, it was, well, I thought I did okay, but then I didn't know if okay was just enough, you know. I might have done more than okay, I don't know, but you don't know the other people, you know, 10, 20, 30 people that you're up against. So, yeah, when I got the phone call, they said they'd contact me within, I think, 10 days, and I think I got a call a day and a half later just from Bass, and I thought it was a goodbye, thank you very much call. And I ran out of the garden, didn't you? Because you thought, oh no, am I going to deal with this? but yeah, they sort of say, how do you think you got on? And I said, well, I don't know. And I got Halley.
did you actually want Halley, or were
yes.
you not? You did?
Yes.
So why did you choose? Why would you have chosen Hallie?
Why did I choose Hallie? The challenge, I think.
It's more extreme than Rotherham, isn't it?
It's more extreme. It's more isolated. You actually rely on your other 10 people, and that was another big thing. Once you got the job, then the next big thing, you go to Girton and you think, oh my God, who am I going to spend 15 months with? Or 8 months isolation, actually, the 15 months is a whole tour. And very lucky, I think.
Did anybody from Bass ever explain to you why you were chosen?
No.
What do you reckon?
No idea. we sort of chat about that while we're there, and it could be we sort of say, well, it could be because we were the only ones that applied, you know. We don't know. No.
Fair enough. Okay. No. So you put the phone down.
Yeah.
Anna was in the garden.
Mm.
Then what?
A few whoops and whoopies. And then a realization that, oh my God, I'm actually going. And they said to take, you know, a few days to actually think about it, because it is slightly different when you get told that you're going. And that's when you really, really think about, right, what am I doing? You know, and, you know, discussing it with Anna. I still wanted to go. And yeah, it was, the decision was sort of underlined, you know, full stop. Yep, gonna go. Mind you, I was still in two minds when we got to Heathrow. Not in two minds, it was sort of just getting on that plane and, you know, leaving Anna behind. Yeah, and my mum.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about Girton then, because you went to Girton College in September 2009.
Nine.
It would have been. And started to meet the other guys who'd also got the positive phone call.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
Oh, that was good. That was good. I pulled up. Girton's got a very small car park with very small places. And I pulled up into the car park reasonably early. And there was quite a posh looking Peugeot fastback thing. And this guy, tall guy, just got out walking in. And I pulled up next to it in my old van, reverse parked it in, and I might have looked as though I got a little bit close. So he came back and gave me a look, and it's all right, I'm not going to touch your van, mate. And it turned out to be Craig. And
Craig Brown,
brilliant, fantastic. And that was our first meeting. And I still said, oh, you gave me a look when, you know. So on building sites, you know, you either talk to people or you don't talk to anybody. So we sort of got chatting and instantly found out we were both going to Hallie. So that was one. And then you meet the rest of the crew. Well, prior to Girton, it's what do I wear? You know, do I get a haircut? Do I not? You know, and then you turn up and they're all the same as you, really. Yeah.
Most of them are younger than you, weren't they?
Oh, I was the oldest at Hallie this year, yeah. But yeah, most of Bass, are, the away guys, are younger than me, yeah.
Was that okay, or did you...
Oh, no, that was fine. I love young people. I don't think I'm too old to get on with them.
Okay. Is any time during those few days at Girton and then again at Coolcar Crags, I think it is?
Yeah.
Did you ever, at any time, have any doubts about it all?
No. There's sort of, blimey, how am I going to cope with that or that? You know, separate, you know, different things, but not doubts that I was going to, you know, go ahead and do what I could at all. Mm. Yeah.
You had to wind up your business, didn't you?
Yes, we were going to do that anyway because we as you know, we've moved back to Bristol. My business is a fair few miles away. But my business is basically me anyway, self-employed. So should I decide to go back to that, I can just start up again and, you know, find some work. Yeah.
So that part of closing things down wasn't a nuisance, wasn't a difficulty?
No, no. It gave me time off because I couldn't take any more work on. So for sort of 3 months, rather than sort of 3 days a week on jobs I was doing and then filling in with other bits that I'd take on, I didn't take on the extra work, which gave me time to sort of prepare, spend time with Anna and the family, and yeah, that was good.
Okay, so we've got you to Heathrow. We've got you past the barrier.
Yeah.
And the handkerchiefs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me about arriving at Halley.
Blimey, that
was. What was the journey like?
Well, the journey, first of all, you go through Cape Town. We had, I think, 4 nights in Cape Town. Lucky enough to be able to walk up Table Mountain and get out and about and have a walk around and, you know, see another part of the world. I mean, it's a city. It's not, you know, the countryside and, you know, you're in shops and malls and stuff like that. But it's still, you know, it was lovely. We saw some penguins down there and they took us down the coast road, which is fantastic. It's like the Amalfi, but, you know, 20 miles of it rather than 4 or 5, yeah. And then on the Ilyushin, which is a Russian, it's an old cargo plane, strapped in. The toilet was a port-a-loo, chained down for the flight into Novo. And it's, what do I wear? And all the guys that had been there before said, oh, you'll be all right, and those boots, those gloves, and those overalls. So you get out, and it lands.
This is a Russian base, this, Novo?
Novo. The plane lands, and, you know, you're waiting to get your bags off, and it's bloody freezing. I think it was about just under minus 20 and about 16 knots, but the clothes that I put on, you know, I should have put Windy on. You don't know, you know. And you do harden to it, you know. It's a bit of a shock, first of all. I mean, we had a lot worse than that over the winter, obviously, but it was blimey.
The plane had no windows at all, or...?
No windows.
Could you see out the windows?
No windows, but somebody had put a camera feed in from the nose of the plane to a screen. So we watched the takeoff and, you know, the landing. There wasn't much to see in between time. It was all black and ocean. But yeah, we could actually see ourselves take off from the nose view. I've got it on a film there. And I'm sure the pilot left it till the last minute to pull up on the gear, because we got a little bit close to the end of the runway and the dual carriage were at the end with all the cars coming off. But yeah, it was good.
You think the pilot knew you were watching?
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
Yeah. What was it like flying in a plane with no windows?
Well, it's pretty much like a night flight anyway. So it was the noise more than anything. Yeah, not the most uncomfortable flight I've ever had. Yeah.
Okay, so you've arrived at Halley.
Right, yeah.
First impressions.
Oh no, you've got to hear about the Basler flight, which I think is one of the only things that you were a little bit jealous about, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So we got to Novo, and we were lucky enough only to spend 4 hours there.
Why do you say lucky?
Well, because some people got stuck there for sort of 4 or 5 days with the weather, and, you know, no showers and Russian food. Apologies to any Russians. No, but we did get that on the Agarica, which I'll tell you about later. And yeah, in and out and to Halley, where you wanted to be. And we flew out from Novo to Halley on a Basler, which is an old DC-3. They've been lengthened and they've got turboprops now rather than the old engines that they had in the war, but I think the ones, Lydia, I can't think of the name of the other one, they're sort of 1943, still flying. One crashed last year, or was it the year? I think it was the year before, and the Canadian pilots went down and stitched it back together and flew it through Halley last winter. And then she was back, I was going to say on the tarmac, but it's not tarmac, it's ice. All looking spick and span and good as new. So, yeah, wonderful flight.
Tell me about arriving at Halley then.
Halley. Arriving at Halley, you're very tired. Your body clock's all over the place. You don't really know what's what and where is where, although it's only sort of three or four buildings. You get a quick tour, but you can't really take that much in. And you're in the permanent sunshine, you know, 24-hour sun. So I think I went to bed with most other people around about 8 o'clock at night local time. I don't know what time that was to me. I think it was probably a lot later. And fell straight asleep and woke up 2 hours later, saw the time 10 o'clock, thought it was 10 o'clock the next morning. Thought I was late for work. And Caroline Lewis, a BC, laughed and told me to go back to sleep. So yeah, and then yeah, you just fall in and you know, find out where you've got to go and what you've got to be doing, and meet your wintering team actually in situ, and they come in drips and drabs. I think Tim, the operator, and Jack.
Tim, second name.
Tim G and Jack Parker, who's the mechanic, were already in. They are an early input to vehicles. As Martin Bell will tell you, vehicles are everything. We have an extensive range. They need to get the vehicles up and running so that things can be moved around, snow can be managed, and you know, the site can come to life again after the winter.
What was your relationship with Caroline like?
Oh no, Caroline was great. Yeah, yeah. She gave me a big kiss and a hug when she came back in this summer. It was one of those. Yeah, yeah.
Any more to say about that?
No, I don't think so.
I'm not looking for negatives. I mean, you
can... No. No, I like Caroline. Yeah.
It must be quite hard to pin down that kind of job anyway, and if most of the people there are the opposite gender to you, were they?
Oh, blimey. What, opposite gender to Caroline?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, there. I think there was probably three or four women on site last year when she was there in the summer. Yeah.
Okay. Tell me about your accommodation. What was it, and how did you feel about it?
Well, it's basically what you expect. It's warm. You've got very limited space. Which you know you're gonna get. I probably took too much stuff down, as everybody did, so some of it never even got unpacked. No, it's exactly what you imagine it will be. Yeah.
Sharing a room?
Not a problem. No. I was lucky enough to have Gareth, who's the Gareth Johnson, who is the summer carpenter. I think he's a bit of a star of the future with Bass. And I didn't even know Gareth was there. No, he was a lovely chap.
So you shared a room in the summer season, but then had a room
in the
yourself.
In the winter. You have a room yourself. I think Richard ended up. I keep mentioning Richard, didn't I? Richard ended up with three for
rooms.
Storage. Yeah, and he won't mind me saying this because he knows it's true. He had what we call clatch everywhere, corridors. Workshops. Richard's wonderful. He takes on 16 projects at a time. Knows exactly what he's doing, but it's getting around, you know.
And Richard's second name?
Richard Sands.
Sands, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, so let's talk about going to work, because presumably you had to be introduced to the work you had to do. I guess there was two kinds of work. There was a routine maintenance work, and then there was emergency stuff.
Yeah, there's routine maintenance, and that comes up on a thing called AMOS. And
on what, sorry?
AMOS.
Is that a computer program?
Yes. Basically, their jobs come up in weekly, monthly, possibly daily. And once you've done the job, you report it and tick it off, and then that generates, you know, the next 4 weeks and the next week. So
what kind of things are we talking about here?
Changing filters, cleaning grifters.
Cleaning?
Grifters.
What's that?
Grifters are, they're macerators. I don't know if you've ever heard of Sunny flows.
We're talking about toilets here, aren't we?
Toilets, yeah. Obviously, there's no mains drainage. So basically, all the toilets go into a tank, and then they're pumped out through a macerator, a pump, which chops everything up and pulps it and pumps it out into an external downpipe, which goes into the snow. And they've got sensors in. When they fill up, the sensor tells the pump when to come on, and when the pump comes on, pumps them out, and then obviously you don't want the pump running all the time, so the low level sensor shuts it off, and bits of, you know, waste and toilet paper get stuck on there sometimes, so your sensors need cleaning, and that's not the most pleasant job.
So you've travelled 10,000 miles to clean toilets?
Oh yeah.
Just to clarify, the waste in the end doesn't stay in the Antarctic, does it?
It does. Yes. Yeah. It goes. It forms a massive great what they call an onion in the ice, and it will just break off with the ice shelf and float away.
Go out to see it melt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, any other routine jobs that you'd like to talk about?
It's just basic routine stuff.
For a non-plumber, what would that include?
For a non-plumber?
I mean, describing it to somebody who isn't a plumber, what sort of things would you still be doing? Presumably you have to maintain the water supply.
Well, everybody does that. The water supply, you dig snow in every day, and that's on a rotor. And basically, yeah, you check the pumps and change duties, because you've normally got duty and standby on everything. So you'd switch over duties, which is just turning a switch from one pump to another, just to make sure they run. You know, you don't have one pump run 3,000 hours and another pump run 10. So you know, once a week or once a fortnight, you change the duty on the pumps, check filters, clean strainers, you know, do rounds, make sure there's no, you know, most of the time I didn't, if there was leaks, which there were, it wasn't me that spotted them a couple of times, but then there's 11 people on base going into the loos. So whoever goes into the loo and says, oh, that, you know, that tap's dripping, or, you know, night person might find something dripping or something like that, or people cleaning. You're on a rotor for cleaning as well. So, you know, if you're mopping behind the loos and you see a drip, then tell the plumber.
Did he ever have a frozen pipe? That was the thing you were most concerned about before you went, I seem to recall.
Yeah, we had a frozen grifter line. And everybody says, bloody plumbers, but it wasn't the plumbers, it's the electrical heat trace that keeps, obviously, pumping out into that atmosphere. It will freeze, so all the pipes are heat traced. And, yeah, it was an old heat trace that failed, which the waste going down there froze. The pump, which pumps up to 5 bar... probably more than that, actually, because it goes round on the stop at 5 bar, so maybe 70-80 psi. Pumps it out, got nowhere to pump it, and then the pipe burst. So there's waste everywhere. And you've got to repair the pump, find the heat trace that's gone down, melt the pipe, thaw the pipe out, replace the heat trace, lagging. And set that to work. And that was an unpleasant couple of days when we did that one.
Why was it unpleasant?
Oh, because there's waste everywhere. It just, these flanges, they're plastic flanges, and they're okay under normal circumstances, but once they get the pressure under, they'll hold for so long, and then just they'll just go, and it's just all over the walls and the ceilings. And
shower of shit.
Yeah, basically.
It's usually,
yeah, I'm glad you said it.
Yeah, sorry.
No, that's good. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there are other emergencies like that that you have to deal with.
Well, I suppose the one that sticks in my mind is, I think, about 10 o'clock at night on a Saturday night, the pump that pumps the water up from the melt tank, that went down. Because all of a sudden our day tank, there's a melt tank under the ice, which melts the water. There's a transfer pump that pumps it up into our day tank, which stores about 2 cubic meters of water. And the pump failed, so our day tank alarm went on, low water. So, yeah, me and Craig went down there about 10, 11 o'clock at night on a Saturday night, and I think we came up about 5 o'clock in the morning, Sunday morning.
Tell me about those 7 hours then.
Well, you first of all go down because...
Down where?
Down the melt tank silo, which is, I think, at its lowest point, about 100 feet below the ice. You've got various levels to go down with trapdoors, sort of a vertical ladder. So, initially, you don't know whether it's an electrical failure. So, it's hence why Craig comes anyway. Craig is probably the most suited to working with me anyway, his experience. You don't know if it's an electrical fault and, you know, everything's shorted out down there. You don't know whether the outlet of the pump is frozen, which would obviously stop water coming up. You don't know whether the outlet of the pump has burst. So initially you go down and investigate, and we found that the pump was... It was a stator, which is a rubber inside, which a worm screw, like an Archimedes screw, turns, and that's how it pumps water. So we found that that one had gone. So then... you're up. We had a spare pump. So you look at your spare pump and then you think, right, what tools do I need to take that bit off? So you don't want to go down with a full toolkit, but you check what spanners you've got and screwdrivers and, you know, have a cup of tea and have a think, right, how are we going to do this? What do we need to shut off? And then, you know, by 1 o'clock, you're back down there. Unfortunately, the pump was an old pump that had been refurbished. There's lots of spares down there, but there's a spring that holds a seal in, and there's a 20 mil shim that forces again, and in the spares packets they're only about 15 mil, and one of these had been put in. It's no, you know, it was no fault of the guy that put in. This was the spares packet for the pump, so we put that pump in, and it leaked, and we took it apart, put it back together 3 or 4 times, and it was like, right, we'll take it up in the light because it's quite dim down there. I mean, you've got head torches, but it's still not the same as actually getting something on the bench. And looking at the old one that had just failed, taking it apart bit by bit, I discovered that the sort of thrust shim was 20 mil longer. So it was like, okay, we'll fit that one. I mean, if that one had been unserviceable, then Matt Hooper, Super Hooper, would have been kicked out of his bed, and he could have turned one up on the lathe. So, you know, the job would have been done. But that, as it was like a non, you know, it wasn't a part it was going to wear. It was just the right one to fit. So stuck them on my back together, and down we went again. Bolted it up, and it's fine. It's been working ever since. So, yeah.
Was it cold out there? I mean, the conditions you were working in, apart from being dark, must have been quite unpleasant.
It's about a constant minus 12 down in the silos, in the tunnels, which, in the winter is quite pleasant, really, because when you've got, you know, when you've got, I think our lowest temperature was almost minus 48. So you'd rather be working down in the silo in the tunnels with no wind and, you know, minus 12 than up. Even a sort of a 3-knot breeze at minus 40 will chill you down. So, yeah, it's not too bad.
One thing which puzzled me listening to the recordings was how, if you're storing all this water under the ice and it's minus 12, why doesn't that water supply freeze?
Oh, right, because it's the heating, it's melted by the heat generated by the generators that give us electricity. There's a flow and return pumped down constantly through a heater battery, like a kettle element, but a big one, and that keeps the melt tank temperature up. And then as it's pumped out, it's heat traced again and insulated all the way up to where it gets to a reasonable ambient temperature on the loss. Yeah.
Great, okay. Talk to any old fit and they'll tell you that one of the biggest problems they had was lack of spares.
Yeah.
In the old days, in the heroic days.
Well,
did you ever hit that problem?
Well, when I say there's too many spares of stuff that you think, like the pump, I think there was probably 15 service kits for that one pump. And there were, when I got there, 15 mil olives, which is an absolute must. I was scratching around for 15 mil olives. So, you know, one of my orders was, we need lots of olives. And there were fittings without olives in, and, you know, because it had been in the past that they hadn't had them, so the plumber had obviously robbed the fitting. You know, oh, there's a new fitting with two or three olives in. We'll need an olive. We'll use those and rob those. So, yeah, there's. You might think there's a lot of spares, but sometimes they're not always needed. And
an olive is a washer, is it?
An olive is a thing on a compression. It's like a metal band, like a wedding ring.
Oh, right.
It clamps to do a compression joint.
Then you screw it tighter.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
So generally speaking, well, the spares has always been a problem in the Antarctic, and I just wonder how efficient it is now compared to how it was in their day. Were you surprised at the lack of certain types of spares, or was everything okay?
You can always get round things. I mean, Rory, who's my replacement this year, he's more a machinist. Well, she is a machinist, and he was actually making olives that we never had for fuel pipes on the lathe. So yeah, sometimes, I mean, if Rory hadn't done it, Matt would have done it, or Jack. You know, there's a lot of skills down there.
So spares management was still a tricky business, was it?
Well, last year I did a complete indent of all our spares. And that takes quite a while, especially with the plumbing. I mean, you know, it's about the worst one, because we've got years of pipework and stuff like that that is no longer used. Like, there's Ventrol, which I think is an old acid waste, and we've still got boxes of fittings for that. It still had to be counted and still had to be ticked off, and, you know, they might use it on the new base. I don't know, but I shouldn't think so.
But you can't throw those things away, can you? You have to send them back.
I was told don't throw anything away. So,
So did you find yourself having to improvise at any time?
Just doing things in a different way, really. If you haven't got plumbers will know what I'm on about, a 28 by 28 by 15 T, you use a 28 equal T with a 28 to 15 reducer, you know. We did have to make up a few reducers ourselves, lathe down bits of brass bar and then drill like a 15 mil hole in to give you a reducer. But yeah, you'd get over it. Or, you know, you'd be down to three toilets rather than four for the rest of the winter. I mean, because at the end of the day, if you can't do it, that's what you're down to. That's why they've got sort of three generators that they can put online, because if one goes down, they can start another one up. You know, so yeah, you can see why things are done as they are, and there's a lot of talk about, oh, we should do it this way or should do it that way, but it would take a lot to change that, and it would take a lot of it could be done, but it would take a consensus. I don't think that's going to happen.
We're talking about resourcefulness here, aren't we?
Oh no, resourcefulness is, yeah, that is a requirement. But having things down there that you should have is another.
Hmm. Yeah. But do you think, looking back on it now, that I shouldn't put words in your mouth, so you can always deny this, that actually they probably thought a 48-year-old plumber was going to be more resourceful than a 24-year-old plumber?
Not necessarily. I mean, my replacement, Rory, is a wonderful chap, and he's not a plumber, but he's got the right attitude.
Okay. Anything else about plumbing before we move on to other things? Was that the trip he did with Mike down into the melt tank?
Yes, we blocked the melt tank on... that wasn't a recording I did, but we did actually block the melt tank midwinter's week, which is when you get your week off. So we all decided we'll have midwinter's day without having to dig melt tank. So we dug it a little bit too much the day before, trying to make it last for 2 days, and managed to block it. So
with snow?
With snow, yeah. Yeah, so.
Tell me a bit more about going down there. Because it sounds like it's a kind of a crystal magic land almost.
Oh, and in places, different levels, you get more crystals. It seems to be about 3 or 4 levels up from the melt tank that it gets cold again. And obviously you've got a bit of moisture in the air, and it all condenses off, and you get, you know, lovely crystal formations. The first time you go down the tunnel shaft, which is, you know, you open a trap door and you're on, you know, a safety wire, but you're looking at a vertical ladder sort of 100 feet down, and you're thinking, blimey. But I mean, you know, it's not the 100-foot drop, it's where it is, you know, on building sites, and you're up scaffolding, and, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. But when you actually start going down the ladder, and the top rungs, I suppose, are a good inch square, and they've got another inch all around of ice on them. So what you're actually holding on to is thick ice bars, you know, for about, I don't know, 10 or 15 rungs, and you do tend to hold on a little bit tighter than you would normally. But yeah, you get used to it. You get used to it.
Is there anything more to talk about plumbing that you feel we ought to know?
Not really. I did enjoy Rory's first grifter clean. Paul, his electrician this year, came out and took a film of him because his eyes were watering. But that's, I think that wasn't far off mine either. You know, it's not pleasant. Yeah.
Okay. Let's get you off base for a bit. Come on, you did some trips, didn't you?
Yes.
You went out
to see the penguins.
Tell me about that. I mean, we've kind of discussed
it before.
Fantastic.
You've seen the pictures.
I've seen one picture, yeah. But yeah. Let's have the full version now for the Bass Arc.
Well, basically, Windy Creek is about 12k away from where Halley 5 is now. It's going to be a lot farther from New Halley 6. It's going to be an extra sort of 18k. So, yeah, on a Sunday, if the weather's okay and the wind's not too much, you get opportunities to go on the back of a snowcat in a German sledge, about 20 at a time, 20 one Sunday, 20 another Sunday, to have a trip down to see the penguins. So you put all warm clothes on, make your sandwiches and make your flasks and jump on the back. It's a bit like a charavan. And yeah, it's a about an hour, no, not even that, about 45 minutes to the caboose, and then probably a 400-500 yard walk to the top of the cliff edge to see the penguins. So yeah, you as you get closer and closer to the cliff, I mean, you've seen the cliffs sort of before, but it's nice to see, you know, you're walking, every view is different, although it's just ice cliffs. The way the sun is in or out makes a difference to what you see, sort of light bouncing around. So you can hear them before you can see them. I can't remember smelling them, but you can smell them while you're down there. And yeah, you're just allowed to walk down onto the ice. You're roped up because it's a bit of a steep slope, and spend some time with them. You don't go too close, but if you stay, you know, quiet and still, they'll sort of come over and have a look. That was wonderful. Although, since being down there, the Adelies are my favourite penguins. That was the king. I'll get shot. That was the emperors. But the Adelies, emperors are quite boring, really. But Adelies are just fantastic.
Why is that?
Well, they think everything's there. They try to chase you off. They'll come and have a look. They'll chase each other. They're much more animated, and you know, emperors are all sort of cool together. You know, Adelies, they're quite bossy, and yeah.
Well, they're in separate places. The two.
Oh no, they will mix. Yeah, you know, there's. Yeah. With the Emperor Colony, I don't think I saw any Adelies there, but when you go to different creeks, you'll see them, and you know, they'll roost together, if that's the right word. Yeah. And they all come up on the barrel line and appear on the base, because basically they'll see a barrel in the distance. We've got a barrel line from the to show us where we go, so every sort of 200-300 yards there's a barrel. Apparently the penguins see a barrel in the distance and think it's a penguin and think, I should go over there and see what's happening. And the barrel doesn't talk to them, so they see another penguin in the distance. And they do actually follow the barrel line 12K or more in, and eventually end up on base. And I think November 2009 we had about 200 emperors on base, which was quite good fun.
When you say on base...
Just walking around. Well, there are no fences or anything, so they just go wherever they want to go. And they do a bit of business by the melt tank, which is not good. So sometimes you've got to clear that away before you can dig ice and snow in for your drinking water. And you don't tend to think too much about that. But there's a UV filter and a filter, so yeah, it's pretty clean before it starts, so it's pretty good.
How were you with the penguins? What sort of experience was it for you?
Oh, brilliant. Just you want to reach out and touch them, but it's, I don't know if some people do, but you just sort of think, no, best not.
Do they touch you?
No, unfortunately. they will come in very close and have a look. And when one comes, you know, three or four will come, and then one will get startled for no reason, and they'll go, and they'll all go. So, yeah, they're birds. Yeah.
What other recreational expeditions did you go on?
Oh, we went climbing, ice climbing. That was this year. That was fantastic. Basically, about 10 of you, and two GAs and Rory, because Rory does quite a lot of climbing, so he's okay for looking after people that go down.
We better have Rory's second name, haven't we?
Rory Fleet.
Flint, thank you.
Fleet. Yeah.
Fleet, okay.
Yeah. Rory the Lion, as he's known. So, I think it was about 12 of us plus those three in a snowcat again out to the cliff edges. And they put in some snow anchors and chuck a rope down. And the cliffs are about 100 foot. Bit of sea ice at the bottom and the sea. And over the sides you go, abseil down, and then you've got your crampons and some ice hacks is to get yourself up. So that was absolutely fine. I mean, it's just like climbing a ladder, really, because it's not like normal climbing where you're looking for handholds. You just put your axe in, but it was a fantastic experience to do it. The setting, we saw young albatross, and that's amazing. They fly into the wind without flapping their wings. God knows how they do that. We all learn.
You can't possibly have experienced, well, have you, ice cliff climbing before?
So no, never. No, and yeah, when you get to the edge of the cliff, I think I was one of the first to go over, because you're all stood there and you're like, who wants to go first? Then it was like, oh, all right, get it over with, you know. And then you want to do it again, obviously. So you don't really want to look over. I don't think I'd look down until I was sort of, I don't know, well below the lip. And once you're on an abseil, you're fine. But actually looking over that cliff and, you know, then having to go over, it's a lot easier just to swing your leg over and go down without looking. The first 10 feet at least, yeah. And then you come up and you go, I want to do that again. But it was nice because the three guys had set up three abseils on sort of three different gradients of climb, so there was none easy. There was, I think, about 90 degrees was the first, and then the last one was a bit of an overhang, so yeah, we had to go all three and didn't fall off, so yeah, quite happy with that.
And that was purely recreational, or was there a kind of practical value to that too?
There would have been if you're on an expedition, and you know, if you're an explorer, it would have been, yeah. But that was purely recreational. Yeah.
Tell me about camping on the ice.
Oh, that's wow. Camping on the ice. You hope it doesn't blow. You're just out with your mates in a wonderful place, and you know, you've got sort of 4 or 5 days, so you've got time to really look, and yeah, you really look. You know, you're not in a rush. You know, you can sit there and actually soak it in and realise where you are. The camping, the tents are great. The sleeping systems are so comfortable and so warm. Actually, we were camping, I think it was only about minus 12. And yeah, it's too warm for minus 12. I mean, Matt will tell you a different story, because Matt Hooper, our Jenny Met, got stuck out for 10 days and it was blowing 50 knots. I mean, it wasn't cold. It was only about minus 4 or 5, but it was blowing at 50 knots, so he had an unpleasant time. But no, camping's great. Yeah.
Did you ever feel any threatened by any of this, or fearful, or?
I did get a little bit scared. I'm the oldest, so it's my duty to take the flag down on the day the sun goes down. I get the honour to take the flag down. And when it comes up again, Jack Parker, who was the youngest, he puts the flag up. And somebody last year, I don't know who it was, it tied knots and knots and knots. So I had to take my gloves off. And it was about minus 20 and sort of 15 knots. And my fingers froze to a point where it was, oh my God, I've got to come in. So I came in and they were actually white and rock solid. And Michael said, really bad frost nip.
Michael's the doctor.
Michael Ramage, yeah. And that frightened me. Well, I don't know if it frightened me, but it made me mindful of what could happen. Because if you go out there and you get cold, you're not going to get warmer until you get into a warm place. You will only get colder. And with all your kit on, minus 20 and 20 knots is not, you know, it's not pleasant, but, you know, just it, you know, I had my hands out for just a minute too long, and yeah, they froze. A couple of months later, I noticed all my nails had bumps in. It was about July, and I said, "Michael, is that diet?" And he said, "No, that's I think it was the 1st of May." And yeah, my nails must have stopped growing for a day or so, and then start again. But yeah, that was a bit of a shock.